is episode 2 Bravo of the Software Freedom Law Show for June 29th, 2010. Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
This is our promised episode that we said we would do.
It's a big day.
Well, today, when we're recording, you see you're confusing people. Because it's not the big day anymore by the time they hear it.
But we promised that we would talk about the Bilski decision as soon as we could, as soon as practicable, but we didn't promise whether we would do it, you know, a day later, 2 days later, 5 days later, or a week later.
Well, we said
and it's, in fact, when we're recording this, is actually the same day, mere hours after the
decision. Yeah, I was saying six, but it's actually 4 hours.
4 hours.
It was our
special guest that pointed out the actual time since Bilski was decided, or published.
Well, yes, but the thing is, they're hearing it the week of Bilski. Because we don't know if it's going to be out tomorrow or the next
right.
day. Somewhere
well, that's
in there.
True.
But the week of Bilski, this is the week.
But I'm sure our listeners can feel our excitement.
I'm not that excited.
Actually, that's a good point. Well, maybe we should introduce our guests so that we can get a...
Well, so did you bite your nails? You said you were going to bite your nails.
I did not literally bite my nails.
But you made a commitment.
Figuratively bit my nails.
You made a commitment to our listeners that you'd be biting your nails.
I was, figuratively.
Well, I literally and figuratively patiently waited, as I promised our listeners I would do. But you didn't come through.
But I did, because I nervously kept checking for the decision every possible day.
Well,
I did everything I could to be neurotic about this decision, Bradley.
Why didn't you run my script, my little Perls program that checked to see if Bilski had been posted yet?
And anyway, I don't think our listeners would want me to literally bite my nails.
That's probably true. But anyway, we've got...
Can we introduce our guest now?
If you really insist that we do, we could just do more of this.
We're actually in his office.
That's true. We have moved the recording studio, and now that I'm correctly using the equipment, which I had trouble with being in a new location with it, but I've correctly used the equipment to record in the office of our guest, who's only once been before even heard on the podcast, and that was a pre-recorded speech. But now he's here in studio with us, our colleague and patent law expert, Daniel Ravisher.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Dan.
I'm happy to be here.
And you're going to tell our listeners what they should think and feel about the Bilski decision in the Supreme Court.
Well, I don't like telling people what to think or feel. I'm sure
they will trust you.
I will give people information, allow them to draw their own conclusions about what to think or feel.
Well, that's a good thing to do, although they probably will trust what you say, because they trust you, Dan. They know that you know this stuff. So what should they think and feel about Bilski?
Well, today was a major development in the world of patent law, and the opinion that is handed down by the Supreme Court will dramatically impact the future of how software patents get evaluated. But before I get to the actual decision today, I want to make sure everyone's on the same page with how we got to the Supreme Court's opinion that got released. So there were these two guys. Bernard and Rand, Bernard Bilski and Rand Warsaw, and they came up with what they thought was an invention on how to help people hedge risk in a fluctuating price for a certain commodity. So they would match buyers and sellers of a certain commodity and work out a certain mathematical algorithm, which would allow them to both be guaranteed a certain price for that commodity so that they weren't subject to dramatic spikes if there was a supply problem or dramatic drops in the price if there was an oversupply of the commodity. So they applied for a patent, and the patent office examiner, whose desk it landed on, rejected the application, said you can't have this because it's not a patentable thing. This is not one of the four categories of patentable eligible subject matter identified in the patent law. And particularly the one word here that's important is the word process. They said this is not a patentable process. So Bernard and Rand didn't like their application being rejected, so they appealed that to the Board of Patent Appeals at the Patent Office and asked the Board of Patent Appeals to reverse the examiner, but the Board of Patent Appeals upheld the examiner's decision to reject the application as not being patent-eligible subject matter. They then appealed that decision to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, And in a decision handed down by all of the active judges of the Federal Circuit, which is a pretty rare thing, but it's called a decision en banc as opposed to a panel decision, which is only issued by three judges on the Federal Circuit, the entire Federal Circuit came together in unison to rule that the application here wasn't patentable because it failed to pass what was known as the machine or transformation test, because the process did not involve a special purpose machine, or it did not transform matter to a new state or thing. It was simply a manipulation of numbers. Then it was not a patentable process. Now, that en banc Federal Circuit decision did have a couple of judges who disagreed with that test. One judge, Judge Rader, who's now the chief judge of the Federal Circuit, said, well, this is not a patentable thing because it's on an abstract idea. The machine or transformation test is not the correct test to determine whether or not something is patent eligible. And another judge, Judge Pauline Newman, said she wasn't sure whether or not this patent application was patentable subject matter or not because all of the underlying issues of whether or not it was on an abstract idea or a concrete idea or concrete implementation of an abstract idea hadn't been addressed. So the Supreme Court decided to hear the case.
Sorry, up for there, Dan. But if people want to go back and listen to old episodes, in episode 01, we discussed that original decision with Scott Peterson. So if people want more about the original decision, they can go back and listen to that.
I would like to go back and see what he said as compared with what happened now. But
But that's where we were as of basically yesterday.
Right. And so in November, the Supreme Court heard the oral arguments in the case, and we here at the Software Freedom Law Center submitted an amicus brief along with nearly 100 other people, our organizations in the case.
And you can hear, we did a podcast with Aaron, I think, about our amicus brief.
That's correct. It was me and Aaron did a podcast regarding the briefs, where we overviewed briefs. That was episode 2 Alpha. Called Waiting for... No, that's the wrong one. 2 Alpha was the Waiting for Bilski one. That was episode 1-8 was where we discussed the briefs. So if you want to review what was said in the briefs, which is just basically people who are interested in the case but not an actual party to the case, what they said, you can listen to that and hear what we said about that. But we did file an amicus brief. The Software Freedom Law Center and the Free Software Foundation filed one, and many other free software and open source companies also filed, as well as I'm not supposed to say evil anymore, but bad organizations like the Business Software Alliance and so forth also filed. So that's the process. There's briefs, and then there's a hearing, right? And then they just sit on it. Is that basically how it goes?
Yeah, right. So the process is there's briefing. Then once all the briefing is submitted, then there's oral argument. Then once oral argument is completed, the case is called fully submitted, and it's left for the judges to decide. And once they decide how they're going to rule, then they have to appoint a certain judge or justice to write the opinion. If any of the other justices disagree with the opinion being written for the court, then they can write separately either to dissent or to technically concur, which means they agree with the result, but they disagree with the reasoning.
Actually, we had a question on IRC before we get into the case about why judges dissent. Can you briefly explain, because I think some listeners don't understand, if they're not part of the majority opinion, why would a justice or a set of justices want to file a dissent or file a different type of agreement as is done in Bilski with the case? What's the motivations for doing that, even though it doesn't officially become part of the finding in the case?
Well, it's actually a very interesting question. Why would a judge write a dissent, especially at the Supreme Court? Sometimes at a lower court, if you have multiple judges on a case, you'll have, such as here in the Federal Circuit, where Judge Rader dissented from the en banc opinion, and he said, I agree with the result, but the test that they're applying is the wrong test. The reason why he's doing that is he's trying to signal to courts above him the argument for a different analysis. But at the Supreme Court, there's no one above you. There's no one really to plead your case to, even though you lost. Technically speaking, realistically speaking, sometimes justices write dissents in order to provoke legislative activity. Sometimes they write dissents in order to encourage a follow-on round of litigation that would press certain issues that weren't fully addressed by the current opinion. And sometimes people just write dissents because they don't want to be seen as agreeing with the majority opinion. They want to at least identify their separate position. But sometimes writing a dissent is a futile thing because it doesn't become the law and you can't cite it as the binding law.
And then there's this other thing where, as we have a lot of in this case, where they're agreeing with the decision, but they have different reasons for agreeing.
Right. This is kind of like in World War II, where the United States and Russia both agreed that Germany was the enemy. But although we agreed on the answer, we did not agree on the methods or reasoning, and we weren't necessarily friends ourselves. It's a bit of a, my enemy's enemy is, you know, my colleague to some extent. So there was a lot of prediction going on in this case because it was fully submitted in November after the argument was heard. And as of this morning, which was the last day of the term for the Supreme Court, so every case heard by the Supreme Court this year.
And that's Monday, June 28th.
Monday, June 28th, right. This was the last day the court was in session for the term, which means they're going to issue all their opinions. There were only four cases that hadn't been decided yet from the term. The Bilski decision was the oldest one. The Supreme Court doesn't wait to issue opinions. If the case had been decided, they would have issued the opinion as soon as it was decided. So what that told us was that this case was taking a long time to be finalized and decided, which indicated that there wasn't consensus amongst the justices on what to say in the opinion. The other influencing considerations, the Supreme Court doesn't usually take cases to just confirm what the lower court did. That'd be a waste of time. If they want to affirm what the lower court did, they would simply deny to take the case on cert. The Supreme Court only takes about 60 cases every year. That's a very small percentage of the number of cases that people ask them to hear. So when they decide to hear a case, that's a very burdensome thing that they are undertaking, and so they're not going to do it to simply say, yes, the lower court got it right. So most people were predicting that they were going to say the lower court here got it wrong, but they weren't exactly sure how they're going to say that and what way, and the fact that there was such an extended time period between the Bilski oral argument in November and the end of June when we got the decision indicated that there was going to be a very fragmented opinion, and in fact, in reviewing the opinion, that's exactly what we have today. So what I'd like to actually do is go through the opinion and without commenting any more than I should, at least as an initial matter, just read some of the passages that the justices wrote. So the lineup was, we have three different opinions, and we have one justice who joins part of one opinion and then joins in another opinion. So I know that's a bit confusing. Usually you have one opinion for the court. Sometimes you have an opinion for the court and a dissent. You frequently see 5-4 decisions from the Supreme Court on issues like abortion and gun control and government rights and things like that, where you have 5 justices in the majority and 4 in dissent. Our situation here is even more confusing than that. We have 5 justices who join an opinion for the court, which is the opinion that you cite as the law. But one of those 5 justices, Justice Scalia, says that he does not join in 2 portions of the opinion. And I'm going to specifically identify those for the listeners. Then what Justice Scalia does is he joins in a concurring opinion by Justice Breyer. And then we also have an opinion by Justice Stevens, which is joined by Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Breyer, which agrees in the result, but disagrees with the reasoning. So let's start with the opinion for the court. And this is what the law is now. And this opinion was written by Justice Kennedy. And so Justice Kennedy describes the background of the case, which I gave you previously. He goes into depth discussing the Federal Circuit opinion and the reasoning there. He cites Judge Rader's concurrence, but for different reasoning. He then gets into the statute at issue, because patent law is all statutory, so this is technically a statutory construction case, and the definition of the word process. And Kennedy's, one of his first quotes that I marked was, he says...
You can also tell listeners just what page you're reading from, because they might want to follow along.
So, okay.
And we'll link to the decision, the...
Yeah, it's a PDF file that you can download.
Yeah, so. From the show notes.
All right. So as of now, this is on page 5 of the slip opinion. When the opinion gets recorded in the Federal Register, it'll be given a full legal citation, and so the page number will depend on whatever page within the book of opinions it gets published. But for now, if you just download the slip opinion, which you guys can link to, it'll be on page 5. So he says, the court's precedents provide three specific exceptions to Section 101, and that's the section of the Patent Act that relates to what are patentable things. There is court precedent that provides three specific exceptions to Section 101's broad patent eligibility principles. And those three exceptions are laws of nature, physical phenomenon, and abstract ideas. Kennedy says, while these exceptions are not required by the statutory text, they are consistent with the notion that a patentable process must be new and useful. And the new and useful language is in quotes because that is what comes from the text of Section 101. So what he's saying is Section 101 says the following things are patentable: machines, compositions of matter, processes. Section 101 does not say that laws of nature, physical phenomena, and abstract ideas aren't patentable. But what Kennedy is saying is those exceptions to the patentable categories are necessary in order to give meaning to the new and useful requirement of Section 101. And then Kennedy continues to say, and in many cases, these exceptions have defined the reach of the statute as a matter of statutory stare decisis going back 150 years. So what he's saying is, generally speaking, 101 should be broadly interpreted, but there are limits, and those limits are defined by laws of nature, physical phenomenon, and abstract ideas.
And the narrowing, that comes from the statute, or that comes from cases that have previously been before the court?
Well, both, because it comes from cases previously before the court interpreting the statute.
I see.
And so he's saying our previous cases which have interpreted the statute have said that there is an exception for abstract ideas and laws of nature. Kennedy goes on to say on page 6, any suggestion in this court's case law that the Patent Act's terms deviate from their ordinary meaning has only been an explanation for the exceptions for laws of nature, physical phenomenon, and abstract ideas. So you can see his general theme is, let's not ask what is a process, because that's irrelevant. What we ask is whether or not you're trying to get a patent on a law of nature or an abstract idea. So when you thought the case was all about defining what's a patentable process, he's actually saying, well, a patentable process is anything that's not an abstract idea or a law of nature. Then we get to a section which Justice Scalia does not join. So this is a section of Kennedy's opinion that only four justices agree with, which is Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Kennedy. So Scalia expressly is not joining this section of the opinion, which is a pretty remarkable thing for Scalia to join most of the opinion, but not this section. And then in this section, Kennedy says, it is true that patents for inventions that did not satisfy the machine or transformation test were rarely granted in earlier eras, especially in the industrial age. But times change. And this fact does not mean that unforeseen innovations such as computer programs are always unpatentable. So that's the first place where we actually see some specific discussion of software.
Right. This is where the part where I really started to feel sick to my stomach. I made the mistake of eating while I was reading this, and I still don't feel better since. Because it's basically, it seems to me it's saying that software is a patentable thing. It could be.
It could be patentable, right? So what and I know that that's it sounds like a very lawyerly thing. Most common people would say you have to either have one position, either software is patentable or it's not. But a lawyer could actually say, no, you can also have the position where you're not saying that it is or is not patentable, because it actually becomes circular, because even if you're to say software is patentable or not, then you're saying, well, what makes something software as opposed to an abstract idea?
For our computer geek listeners, he's talking about three-state logic: true, false, or null. So they'll understand that.
Okay. All right. So again, you know, the case is all about what's a patentable process, and now we're punting that question. Instead of trying to define what is a process, what we're defining is what's not patentable as an abstract idea. And so what he's saying in this section, which remember Scalia doesn't join, so there are only four justices of the Supreme Court that think this, which is a minority, not a majority. He says that, you know, computer programs could, the word computer program could describe something that's not just an abstract idea, and therefore it could be patentable.
Do you have any idea why Scalia didn't join that part of it?
Well, we're going to get to that later on. because Scalia, as I mentioned earlier, didn't join a concurring opinion by Breyer, and so we'll see what Scalia and Breyer have to say at the end. So then Kennedy continues, and this is still a section that Scalia did not join, and Kennedy says, but there are reasons to doubt whether the machine or transformation test should be the sole criteria for determining the patentability of inventions in the information age. Now recognize, he had just earlier discussed the industrial age, and now he says we're in the information age, and because times have changed, different rules might be applicable. And Kennedy goes on to say, in fact, the machine or transformation test would create uncertainty as to the patentability of software. Now, that's exactly what we had all said. I'm sure on your earlier podcast you had said the machine or transformation test of Bilski calls into question the patentability of software. And Kennedy agrees with that. He says the machine or transformation test would create uncertainty as to the patentability of software. It would also create uncertainty as to the patentability of advanced diagnostic medicine techniques and inventions based on linear programming, data compression, and the manipulation of digital signals. And here, I'm sure this also made you sick, he cites the brief filed by the Business Software Alliance.
Yeah, indeed.
So he's concerned here for exactly what you recognized and we all recognized was reality, which was the Federal Circuit's Bilski decision called into question the patentability of software. And he's saying here that that's something we should be concerned about as society. Then he continues to say, Kennedy does, in the course of applying the machine or transformation test to emerging technologies, courts may pose questions of such intricacy and refinement that they risk obscuring the larger object of securing patents for valuable inventions without transgressing the public domain. In deciding whether previously unforeseen inventions qualify as patentable processes, it may not make sense to require courts to confine themselves to asking the questions posed by the machine or transformation tests. Section 101's term suggests that new technologies may call for new inquiries, and this is on page 9. So it's kind of backwards to me that say new technologies require new law, right? We've always been told, and you're frequently told, that the law should be applicable to the society as it advances.
So is that saying that things should be more patentable the more technologies we have? I read it as basically saying that the more technologies and different technologies have, the more patentable material.
I didn't read it like that at all, actually. No, I mean, I just thought that it's sort of, because when you say something is not necessarily unpatentable, that doesn't say that it is. And maybe it's a lawyerly reading of it, but it says the door isn't closed, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily more likely to be patented.
Well, in the past, to be fair, the Supreme Court has tried to set down bright-line tests, and then when new technologies have been developed, those bright-line tests have proven to be either unworkable or undesirable. And so what I think he's saying here is we can't predict the future technology, so we don't know what tests would be applicable, so let's not set it. Some could say that that's a cowardly thing to do, which is to just punt and wait for the future and try to let other people to do it. Some would say that the Supreme Court is supposed to take on these tough issues and set down precedent that can be applicable to the future to reduce uncertainty. But for whatever reason, Kennedy chose not to do that. So the big line here is Section 101's term suggests that new technologies may call for new inquiries. So you have two points of ambiguity in that sentence. Whether or not this new technology deserves a new inquiry is one question. Then if you answer that yes, what is that new inquiry? So there is a double layer of ambiguity here and imprecision that makes it impossible to predict how this could be applied. He goes on to say, it's important to emphasize that the court today is not commenting on the patentability of any particular invention, let alone holding that any of the above-mentioned technologies from the information age should or should not receive patent protection. The patent law faces a great challenge in striking the balance between protecting inventors and not granting monopolies over procedures that otherwise would that others would discover by independent creative application of general principles. Nothing in this opinion should be read to take a position on where that balance ought to be struck. So he's saying that the line of what is or is not patentable is a policy decision between, do we need to protect inventors? Do we not, or do we need to protect the public from monopolies? Which seems to be a very unsatisfying legal standard if you're going to allow it to fall down to basically a policy debate.
Well, notwithstanding that I don't think that patents protect anybody. But putting that aside, it seems to me that this is exactly what everybody was somewhat worried about, that they wouldn't actually give any guidance about patentability of anything, really. I mean, they're considering only this one patent, and they're saying that, oh, there's things you should think about, but they're not actually giving any information.
Well, let's see the glass as half full. It was completely possible that the Supreme Court could have come out 9-0 unanimously that this patent and every other patent is patent eligible. There are judges and there were many commentators who said that that would be the correct answer, that everything under the sun made by man is patentable. There are no exclusions from patent eligible subject matter in the statute. The court's opinions grafting on those abstract idea laws of nature, natural phenomena exceptions are wrong. So the decision could have been very, very bad in saying that, because then there'd be no room to argue that software and other things are ineligible. But this is a more fuzzy standard that moves away from the Federal Circuit's Bilski test, which was a clear test that, as Kennedy concedes, raised substantial doubts about whether software was patentable.
And they call that test a clue in this decision.
Well, now you're preempting me. Yeah, we're going to get there. So now we're back to a section of the opinion. So we finished that opinion where he's saying, you know, the new technologies may require new inquiries. We're not opining about whether these new technologies are or not patentable. That's left to be decided in another day. Now we're back into a part of the opinion where Scalia joins. So notice Scalia sat out that section where Kennedy wrote that. And this, and then we're back in, and Kennedy says the term method, which is used within the Patent Act's definition of the word process, at least as a textual matter and before consulting other limitations in the Patent Act and this court's precedents, may include at least some business methods. So business methods are not categorically excluded. In another section of the opinion where Kennedy goes on to discuss other issues, Scalia again withdraws his support. And in this section, which is back to only four justices, Kennedy says, if a high enough bar is not set when considering patent applications regarding mathematical calculations and statistical analysis, this is on page 12, patent examiners and courts could be flooded with claims that would put a chill on creative endeavor and dynamic change. So it seems as though Kennedy is saying one of the questions we should ask about whether or not something's patentable is whether or not it chills creative endeavor. So if that's part of the test, then we could say, well, software patents have a substantial chilling effect, and that would be a factor arguing that they're not patentable.
I think the frustration that most of our listeners will have with this is that they are already well aware that this chilling effect is occurring, and it seems like it's years and years away. If they're saying that now they're saying it could be a chilling effect, that means the court's 10 years away from saying there's a chilling effect at least, right? So it seems like it's almost too little too late to have that said.
Well, and part of the problem is here is the people that the Supreme Court listens to are the people that submit briefs. It's a little improper for them to just go out and do their own investigation of issues. And so the people who have the interest and the resources to submit briefs aren't necessarily representative of the entire community. While we submitted our brief and other pro-free software organizations submitted their briefs, there are also briefs submitted by BSA and other or companies who have incentives to propel the patenting of computer programs. So the Supreme Court may not have gotten an accurate picture of what actual software developers think. Instead, they got a picture of what financial interests in the software field think.
Yeah, as we mentioned in our briefs podcast, the IEEE, which is generally considered to represent individual creators, individual inventors, individual programmers, actually submitted a very pro-software patent brief, as it turned out. So even the organizations that are supposed to represent those interests were not, as it turned out.
But there were briefs on the other side, as we were talking including our briefs, but there were some.
But I think Dan's point is correct that there was this propensity of pro-software patent briefs.
Sure.
Okay, when you line them up, there was a lot more of people pro-software patent than against.
Mm-hmm. And I hope people are evaluating it. You know, I don't like it often when you ask people what did a court say and they paraphrase themselves. I'm generally more of a let the court's opinion speak for itself. And we'll all discuss it in a minute, but I think this is, people really want to know, it's important. You know, this is one of the biggest decisions about software patents and patentable subject matter of the last 25 years, or 30 years. So it's, you know, it's important to actually read the language and listen to the justices in their own words. So Kennedy continues to say, and this is a part of the opinion where Scalia's back in, so he agrees with this.
So it's on page 13 now.
Page 13, right. Even though petitioner's application is not categorically outside of 101 under the two broad approaches the court rejects today, and the broad approaches were, one, machine or transformation is required. The court said, nope, that's not true. Two, business methods are excluded. The court said, nope, that's not true. Some business methods could be patentable. Kennedy says that does not mean it is necessarily a process under 101. Rather than adopting categorical rules that might have wide-ranging and unforeseen impacts, the court resolves this case narrowly on the basis of this court's prior decisions, which show that petitioner's claims are not patentable processes because they are attempts to patent abstract ideas. So this goes back, remember, when I said initially, was Kennedy was setting this all up by saying, this case is about what does it mean to be a process, and what it means to be a process is something that's not an abstract idea. So what we're really asking is this a patent on an abstract idea or not? And then Kennedy says, indeed, all members of the court agree that a patent application at issue here falls outside of 101 because it claims an abstract idea. And then he goes on to discuss his the court's prior cases. And says, you know, one way you know that a patent is on an abstract idea is if it preempts the use in all fields. So the concept of hedging described in Claim 1 and reduced to a mathematical formula in Claim 4 is an unpatentable abstract idea, just like the algorithms at issue in Benson and Fluke. Allowing petitioners to patent risk hedging would preempt use of this approach in all fields and would effectively grant a monopoly over an abstract idea. So one way...
So this is where, just to guide our listeners a little bit, this is where they're going and looking at the actual claim of Bilski's patent and, right. and now trying to decide whether or not it's an abstract idea or not.
Right. So the whole inquiry is, can I have a patent on this? And the answer is it a patent on an abstract idea? Well, how do you know whether it's a patent on an abstract idea? How does an idea go from being abstract to be an idea that's being applied in a concrete way? One of the things you can look for is whether or not it would preempt use in all fields. Kennedy goes on to say Fluke, which was another case from the Supreme Court in the 70s. Fluke established that limiting an abstract idea to one field of use or adding token post-solution components did not make the concept patentable. So it's if you're preempting the use of the formula or the algorithm in all fields, then that makes an abstract idea. Even if you limit it to one field of use, that's still an abstract idea. And then in concluding, Kennedy says, the patent application here can be rejected under our precedents on the unpatentability of abstract ideas. The court, therefore, need not define further what constitutes a patentable process beyond pointing to the definition of that term provided in the Patent Act and looking to our prior cases. Nothing in today's opinion should be read as endorsing interpretations of 101 that the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit had used in the past. By that he means the State Street opinion, where the Federal Circuit had said anything that produces a useful, concrete, and tangible result is acceptable. He says that we're not endorsing that, so we're not going all the way back to State Street. It may be that the Court of Appeals thought it needed to make the machine or transformation test exclusive precisely because its case law had not adequately identified less extreme means of restricting business method patents, including but not limited to application of our prior opinions. In disapproving an exclusive machine or transformation test, we by no means foreclose the Federal Circuit's development of other limiting criteria that further the purposes of the Patent Act and are not inconsistent with its text. Well, that's a little bit disingenuous. They're saying, I don't care if the Court of Appeals does anything that I would say is allowed, right? So let me just read that sentence. In disapproving the machine or transformation test, we by no means foreclose the Federal Circuit's development of other tests that further the purposes of the Patent Act and are not inconsistent with its text. Well, you don't know what furthers the purposes of the Patent Act and are not inconsistent with its text unless the Supreme Court tells you. Because obviously the Federal Circuit thought its machine or transformation test did further the purpose of the Patent Act and was not inconsistent with its text. And the Supreme Court is saying, nope, it is, and so that's a bit disingenuous. Well, we don't mind if the lower court does something that we would agree with. Well, how are they supposed to know what you would agree with if you don't tell them?
So what's the lower court supposed to do? So let's this is the end of the the plurality opinion, I guess. So what are lower courts supposed to do? Suppose there's another patent up in front of them. Maybe it's a software patent. Who knows, a business method patent, whatever it might be. How are they supposed to use that part of the ruling, which is what they should be looking at, because that's the majority or plurality opinion, to figure out what to do.
Well, they're going to ask themselves questions. Question one, is this a patent on an abstract idea? Well, how do we know that? Does it foreclose the use of an algorithm in all fields? That would seem to indicate that it is an abstract idea. Is it a patent that even though it's limited to a particular field of use, it's still on an abstract idea? And the plurality says that the machine or transformation test can be insightful, it can be a clue, it can be a hint, but it's not the conclusive outcome determinative test to be applied. So this makes it the more subjective test, a less predictable test, a more judge-specific test. It gives more power to the decision-maker to decide whether their gut tells them that it is or is not a patent effectively on an abstract idea, which creates more uncertainty and less predictability.
So how is this any different from what we had before this whole Bilski thing went through the courts?
It's not. We're back to basically where we were before Bilski started.
So it's kind of a no-op.
Right.
So that's unfortunate.
Right. Okay, so let me just go through the other two opinions. Justice Stevens, and this is his... Right,
so Stevens, to be clear for us, Stevens agreeing with the majority opinion. He's saying, I agree Bilski should not have gotten this patent.
He's only agreeing in result.
Right, yeah. He's agreeing Bilski should not have gotten
right,
the patent.
Right. So this is kind of like, you know, in third grade where you have to show your proof, right? You know, you can have two students who got the same answer, but they did it completely different ways. And that's why you had to show your proof. And just getting the right answer wasn't necessarily always the right thing. So, and notice the opinion for the court says that the Federal Circuit got the right answer, but they're saying they did it completely with bad law. They got it the wrong way. So Stevens' opinion goes on for many, many pages.
It's really, really long. Right. Would you recommend it as reading for people interested in the history of patent law?
Not really.
Or, no.
I don't find much value in Stevens' opinion. One, he's leaving. So this is the, so what he thinks is now going to be a little bit irrelevant because he's no longer going to be on the court. And two, I don't see much in it of value. It seems to be more editorialism than legally sound reasoning. So let me just go through basically what he says. He says, you know, I'm agreeing that this patent is not allowed.
And for folks following along, page numbers reset when you get to the new opinion. We haven't been giving PDF page numbers, but rather page numbers of the decision. So this resets to page one, right, for Stevens.
But in the PDF, it's...
Yeah, in the PDF, it's somewhere around 21.
Just so that people know roughly where in the document.
Yeah, it's around 21 in the PDF.
Right, so he starts off by saying, you know, as the entire court agrees, the machine or transformation test is reliable in most cases. It is not the exclusive test. And then he says, I would restore patent law to its historical and constitutional moorings. And by that he means patent law as a historical thing did not allow patents on methods of doing business. And he goes on to discuss facts and case.
Yeah. But how does software fit in with the methods of doing business?
Well, we're not sure. There hasn't been much precedent about that. And these are categorizations. What one person calls a software patent, another person could call a business method patent. And so what this case is tending to say is we have to look at them on a case-by-case basis. And instead of saying this is a software patent, we're going to say, well, what is it a patent on? Is it a patent on an abstract idea, or is it not on an abstract idea? Is it on, you know, the implementation of an idea in a concrete way? And so that's why, you know, I understand the frustration. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you're trying to look out over the landscape and be able to see clearly where you're going, but there's a huge fog in front of you. And that's simply the fog that we've been given. And the right answer is not to say, well, I dislike fog, so I refuse to recognize that there is fog in my path. The right answer is to say, I have fog in my path, it's not my fault, and I'm going to do my best to, you know, see my way through the fog and prepare myself for any risks that the fog poses to me. There might be a car coming right at me that I can't see right now. I need to be prepared for that. And so, you know, it's unfortunate that this is what we've been given, but it is what it is, and we have to do the best we can. Like I said, it could have been much worse. The court could have come out and said, everything's patentable, business method, software, everything, so we don't have that. It could have been better. The Supreme Court could have come out and said this and all other patents on business methods aren't patentable, and anything that's just an algorithm isn't patentable. That would have been better. So we're in the middle, and...
I don't necessarily agree that the worst possible outcome, what looks like the worst possible outcome, would actually be the worst outcome. Because if it was so bad that they said everything's patentable everywhere, they said Bilski deserves a patent and so forth, that might have pushed people to be more upset about the issue. That's one advantage you might have. Also, the more bad patents there are, the safer free software is from so-called good patents, i.e. patents that are very strong that can't survive a re-exam and so forth. I like there to be lots and lots of grenades, most of which are duds, rather than a few grenades, all of which are lies.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing here. If people are really upset to get this problem fixed, I think we've now learned repeatedly we can't rely on the courts to do it for us.
Right, and that I think we agree on.
We're going to have to do, you know, we're going to have to take matters into our own hands and be more proactive and do more private ordering and other things like that in order to address these concerns, because the court isn't going to fix it. Congress is completely incapable of fixing the patent law because they are captured by pro-patent interests. The patent office is, you know, an underfunded, understaffed, captured agency by patent applicants. So
now this doesn't sound like a serious question, but it actually is. Other than regime change, what actually can change it? If you can't change it through the courts, you can't change it through the legislature, where else can you change it?
Well, where you can change it is, you know, to me the most powerful thing isn't the vote, but your dollar. You know, you vote with your wallets is the saying that, you know, I use. And so this needs to start becoming an issue for people, much like dolphin-safe tuna and environmentally friendly cars. And, you know, what we have is an oil spill that's been created by companies. The companies that have created this oil spill say they're trying to clean it up, but they're being inept at doing so. The government finally has reluctantly tried to get involved to clean up the oil spill. It's incapable of doing so. Let's recognize the United States government here was on our side, arguing that this is not a patentable thing. The United States government was arguing in support of the machinery transformation test. So what we have to really start do is, if people are outraged by this, they need to start acting that way and refuse to transact business and encourage people to collect their voices together in unison, and we actually need to make this a policy issue that we care about. So, but let's just finish going through the opinion itself.
You're on page 6 now of Stevens's opinion.
Yeah, I'm just going through it, and here's one of the things I don't like about Stevens's opinion. I mean, he's one of the things I don't like about a lot of judges is that they get very bitter and cynical in their positions. And you know, as I always say, you know, I had this judge one time I was in front of him, I'm not going to say which court or what gender or anything like that. But this judge was just one of the most bitter, angry, mean-spirited people you'll ever meet. And I was so upset by this because I'm like, no one's forcing this judge to keep the job. The judge could quit, go get a job as a high-priced lawyer. You know, no one's holding a gun to this judge's head and requiring the judge to keep the job. And there's never an excuse for anyone to be disrespectful and to be cynical and snide, because that just encourages us who have even less power than the judge to adopt that cynicism. And that's not going to make society better. If we're all just a bunch of cynics walking around, we're not going to be empowered to make the world a better place. So yes. I don't like it when judges act that way.
Yeah. Now, Stevens, who wrote this opinion, actually is leaving. So this is his last term, but this was his last day.
Right, so...
Yeah, literally his last day. I didn't even think of that. Yeah. That's literally his last day. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's kind of weird when you think about it.
Right, so what Stephen says is... so he goes, I'll comment briefly on the court's opinion. It's less than pellucid, which I have never even heard that word before.
I had to dict it as well.
It means it's less than transparent.
Yeah, I knew that from the Latin, but I looked it up anyway.
And so, but you see, he's saying the court's opinion is a bit circular, which, you know, has some merit, and that's fine. But let's just hold on to that and see if he's subject to his own criticism. So he goes on to discuss, he says, the opinion uses some language, the court's opinion, which I just finished going through a few minutes ago, uses some language that seems inconsistent with our centuries-old reliance on the machine or transformation criteria as clues to patentability. Most notably, the opinion for the plurality suggests that the criteria may operate differently when addressing technologies of a recent vintage. So here he's expressing my complaint, which is the law can't change because times have changed, right? I mean, if the law is supposed to change, Congress is supposed to update the law. It's not the function of the courts to update the law for new technologies. So Stevens criticizes the plurality for doing that, which I think is a valid criticism. And he goes on to say the machine or transformation test remains an important test. He says the opinion for the court artificially limits petitioner's claims to hedging and then concludes that hedging is an abstract idea rather than a term that describes a category of processes including petitioner's claims. So what he's saying is you've simply said, well, this isn't on an abstract idea, that's why it's not patentable. But how did you come to that test? What's the test for determining whether something's on an abstract idea? You weren't clear with that. And that's what you asked me. Well, how do we apply this going forward? And I said, well, we look to see whether or not there's preemption, that preemption in all fields, or is it just insignificant post-solution activity that's been added to the patent? So Stephen says, the court, in sum, never provides a satisfying account of what constitutes an unpatentable abstract idea. And I think he's right about that. Mm-hmm. I think this is a majority opinion which does not provide us good guidance going forward. It basically says this is an unpatentable thing, but good luck figuring out what's unpatentable in the future. We'll see you in a couple years again, same place, same time. Then Stevens goes, and if he had stopped there, then I would have, you know, supported Stephen's opinion, but then he goes on for pages.
He takes us a walk all the way back to English common law and patentable subject matter under English common law, which I thought was that's not common in decisions, is it? I had a feeling I was reading something that doesn't happen that often.
It sometimes does.
Sometimes you do have judges that like to go into historical underpinnings. It's usually a trick you use to make it seem as though what you're proposing is what's old is new again, right? So if you're trying to propose something that seems radical and different and crazy, you just go back and find it being proposed in the past, and you can say, oh, it's not a new idea. This is an old, it's as old as our country is. And
yeah, in fact, one of the things that everything old is new again was in there, when he went all the way back to the English common law question, he pointed out this patent that had been on lotteries and other types of systems in long ago in England, and said, but no one's ever actually tried, no one actually tried that, or no one ever considered its patentability, and it never looks like it was ever enforced at all. So it could have just been a rogue patent examiner who granted a patent they shouldn't have. And I thought, yeah, isn't that what happens a lot?
And if you were here sitting with us, you would see Dan just flipping through page after page after page of Stephen's opinion.
Yeah, you don't need to read it. It's him going through the historical story that he wants. We all know history is manipulated by the people who want to tell it. You know, the recent Texas history book scandal where they're choosing history books that told the story of history that they wanted. And so we all know history is manipulated by the people who want to tell it the way they want to tell it. And so he goes through and he says, look, all throughout history, business methods have never been eligible for patents. And he goes into the fact that this term useful arts, which is in the Constitution, was never meant to include business methods. And so he's all saying...
Well, see, I like that he brought that up, because that's one of the things that we always go to in the free software world, is asking the question of whether or not a software patent promotes progress in the science and the useful arts. And we always argue that it does not promote progress, therefore it's unconstitutional. But does his decision give us any more gumption, at least, to be able to use that argument?
No, because he's not relying on the promotion of useful arts,
right,
which would be the prong that you would be challenging it under. He's saying this was not a useful art.
I see.
So, you know, you could theoretically say that the patent acts allowing for patents on things that were not useful arts is not allowed by the Constitution. That'd be a very pioneering type of argument.
I don't want to argue that computer science is not a useful art. That's not where I want to go. given my degree list, that's not what I want to say.
Right. So Stevens' concurring opinion is twice as long as the majority opinion. One of the things that is valuable to take from Stevens' opinion is on 32 of his opinion, there's been this argument made by the pro-patent side that, well, the legislative history of the Patent Act says that anything under the sun made by man is patentable. And those of us who actually know what we're talking about and are honest with legislative history said, you've taken that completely out of context. That's not what it was meant. But the pro-patent hawk people don't want to concede that they are doing a disservice to legislative history. So Stevens does a good job of smacking those people right in the face and saying, stop lying. And so I'm going to take a minute and just go through that. He goes, if you take that the legislative history in context, it's apparent that the quoted language has a far less expansive meaning. The full sentence in the committee reports, which is the legislative history at the time of the Patent Act, reads, quote, a person may have invented a machine or a manufacture which may include anything under the sun that is made by man, but it is not necessarily patentable under Section 101 unless the conditions of this title are fulfilled. So,
now, but I noticed they didn't consider whether it was made by woman or not.
Well, that's true, because back then women didn't make things.
Okay. Right? Well, I don't know if that's
true. Or man is the gender-neutral term for human. In that context.
Apparently in 1979 and 1983 it was.
I'm sure we could do several podcasts about sexism and racism in all facets of the law, including intellectual property, or patent law.
Anyway, I just want to...
Then Stevens continues, says, viewed as a whole, it seems clear that this language does not purport to explain that anything under the sun is patentable. Indeed, the language may be understood to state the exact opposite, that a person may have invented anything under the sun, but that thing is not necessarily patentable under Section 101, which is a good response to those people who say, oh, but the Patent Act is anything under the sun made by man. And like I said, that was the doomsday scenario for Bilski. The doomsday scenario for Bilski was anything under the sun made by man is patentable. And that could have been the opinion we got today, and it's clearly not. So... That's a good thing.
I don't know if I agree with that, but we'll move on.
So Stevens' whole opinion is about the fact that business methods should not be patentable. He doesn't talk about software. He doesn't talk about other types of methods. He doesn't limit himself to the definition of the word process. He just says business methods are not patentable. And then towards the end of his opinion, he says, the constitutionally mandated purpose and function of the patent laws bolster the conclusion that methods of doing business are not processes under 101. And he cites a 2008 Supreme Court opinion called Quanta v. LG Electronics. In that opinion, the Supreme Court said, the primary purpose of our patent laws is not the creation of private fortunes for the owners of patents, but is to promote the progress of science and useful arts. And that's always a very important point to raise with people when you're debating patent policy. The Patent Act and the patent system is not to incentivize innovation by making people rich. The purpose of the Patent Act is to advance the state of the art. This is why we don't have patents that last 100 years, things like that. Then Stevens goes on page 40 to say, on one side of the balance is whether a patent monopoly is necessary to motivate the invention. Although there is certainly disagreement about the need for patents, scholars generally agree that when innovation is expensive, risky, and easily copied, inventors are less likely to undertake the guaranteed cost of innovation in order to obtain the mere possibility of an invention that others can copy. Both common sense and recent economic scholarship suggest that these dynamics of cost, risk, and reward vary by the type of thing being patented, and the functional case that patents promote progress generally is stronger for subject matter that has historically been eligible to receive the protection of our patent laws than for methods of doing business. So again, he's getting into policy issues about there's some types of technology that are more likely to benefit from a patent system and others that are not. So,
well, and that's actually very consistent with the typical position you find in the free software community or generally in computer science about patents, that no one in the computer science world generally argues that okay, if you have to build a giant factory to make use of the idea, then it makes sense that maybe you need a patent because it's so easily copied because someone else can leapfrog you. Whereas with computing, everybody has that factory already because it's their computer and it only takes them a few weeks at most to code up an idea and make it work. And therefore, there's not this issue of that particular thing happening to them.
Right.
So I think that's consistent with that, but this doesn't really give us anything. It's not like we can say, well, Stevens said in this opinion because he's not the majority opinion. It doesn't give us any...
What is good is it's the first indication of Sotomayor's positions, because Sotomayor is a new justice. She didn't have a patent background, and so it's a good sign that she's at least concerned about patent eligibility questions.
Saying that because she signed on and she agreed with Stevens's
right. And the other thing in that statement I just read that's interesting is Stevens said patents are perhaps more necessary for technologies that can be easily copied. Well, as we know, most software developers don't copy another person's software. They independently write it their own, right? And we have copyright to protect per se copying. So there's a good argument there that says, you know, the policy, you know, what Stevens is implying, which I disagree with, but what he's implying is things like pharmaceuticals, which, you know, any high school student can go grab a pill and determine what chemicals are in there and then copy it and make the same thing. And in those industries, and he cites some Law Review articles, and there's a good book by Jim Besson and Mike Muir called Patent Failure that talks about what industries do patents create a net incentive on innovation and what industries do patents create a net drag on innovation. But we also, whenever we're talking about pharmaceuticals, just to take an aside, whenever we're talking about pharmaceuticals and anyone who says we need patents on drugs, they need to remember that the FDA grants exclusive marketing to anyone who comes up with a new drug. So we have a belt and suspender system for drugs. We give them exclusivity under the FDA law. If you come up with a new drug, the FDA won't let anyone else sell it for a number of years so you can make all your monopoly profits. So whether or not we need a patent on top of that, I highly doubt, because the patents just seem to give the pharmaceutical companies an additional leverage for monopolization, which they already get under the FDA law. So,
and just to promote Dan's other activity, he's done work in this area related to pharmaceuticals at pubpat.org if you want to read more about his work in the pharmaceutical area of patenting.
Right. But so let's come back in the software. So what you see here is that the Stevens says business methods should not be patentable because they're not subject to the same copying risks and large investment risks. And there are other incentives for people to develop new methods of doing business, namely developing a cheaper, faster, better product to a consumer and the market opportunity. That's also the big fallacy that pro-patent hawks make. They say, well, we need patents to incentivize innovation. Well, that's true. Why don't we have cures for malaria? You can get all the patents you want on a cure for malaria. We don't have any innovations in malaria because there's not a large, rich, white market opportunity for people. We have innovation where there's a market opportunity, and patents are just an afterthought by most people. But I digress. So summarize 47 pages written by Justice Stevens. Could all have been said in one sentence, which is business methods were never allowed under any historical understanding of the Patent Act, and they shouldn't be allowed today. So we have, just to review, the majority opinion says that abstract ideas are not patentable. Stevens's concurrence says business methods are not patentable. And then we get to the final opinion, which is
just
written,
one question on Stevens's statements. Some people said that they wished Stevens' statements had been the majority opinion, but you actually were saying that you felt that it was better if it was not, that we're better off with the majority opinion as it was. Can you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, because although it appears to be satisfactory, we would get into the same line-drawing problem, what determines whether or not something is a business method or not. In fact, you know, Stevens is, through his 47 pages discussing business method, makes analogies to, like, the FedEx package delivering method and the trading of, you know, various commodities. And if those were the examples which would define business methods, then it would be hard to argue that software would fall under business methods. And so his opinion saying business methods aren't patentable may have impliedly said that software was patentable, or wouldn't have said anything about software at all. Whereas the plurality opinion, the court opinion, which says abstract ideas are not patentable, and this is on an abstract idea, that is at least a categorical name for something that more easily applies to software, right? If I have a patent on software, is it more easily to say that that is a patent on an abstract idea or that's a patent on a business method? I think if you could only use one of those two categories to put it in, it's easier to put software under abstract idea, generally speaking, than under business method.
So this is a point I need some clarification on, because I had heard years ago that people said the only reason software was patentable is because it could be characterized as a business method. Is that incorrect, or is it just all more complicated?
Well, no, that was correct at one time, because the first opinion on this was a patent on, was in State Street on a business method. Right? Then you had the AT&T case. So, you know, neither software nor business methods were allowed at one point. There was a business method case. The Federal Circuit said business methods are allowed. So then
and
all
that was
the
State Street, right.
Right. So then all the software people said, oh, well, we're a business method, right? But now if you had the opposite, if you said, if you had a Supreme Court opinion that said business methods aren't allowed, well, then you'd have all the software people saying, well, we're not business methods, right? So it was a correct statement at the time. I wouldn't think it would be correct.
I see.
And at the end of the day, you're still trying to decide, well, what makes something a business method as opposed to software or a machine or something else?
And what makes it abstract or not if we look at the other side?
So if you really want to, if your listeners really want to read something here and they don't have much time, I would simply tell them to read Breyer's concurrence, which is the last four opinions
so
of the PDF.
To flip four, the
four,
rest of it.
It's four pages of the PDF. The PDF page numbering is 68.
Right.
So what were you saying, Karen?
No, I was going to say, so you have to either flip through or scroll through the rest of the very long opinions in order to get to the short opinion at the end.
Right. So this is the Cliff Notes version. And this is Breyer and Stevens trying to play...
Or you mean Breyer and Scalia?
I mean, yes. Sorry. Breyer and Scalia trying to play peacemaker. You have Breyer, which was one of the four who joined the Stevens concurrence, and then you have Scalia, who joined the court's opinion, except for those two sections. They come together, and they write an opinion, and what they say is, we agree with Justice Stevens that a general method of engaging in business transactions is not a patentable process within the meaning of 35 U.S.C. 101. I write separately, however, in order to highlight the substantial agreement, and he italicizes the word agreement. So he's trying to say, look, we really do all agree here.
And just as a point of order, so Justice Breyer is writing in Section 1 in this opinion, but Scalia doesn't agree with his Part 1, right? Scalia only agrees with Part 2. So this is Stevens by himself in Part 1 speaking, right? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
So... Breyer says, I write separately in order to highlight the substantial agreement among many members of the court on many of the fundamental issues of patent law raised by this case. And so in Section 2, which Scalia joins now, Breyer and Scalia say, the following four points are consistent with both the opinion of the court and Justice Stevens' opinion concurring in the judgment. And here's his four points. First point, Section 101 describes what is patentable is very broad but not limitless. Okay? Second point, the machine or transformation test is the clue to determining whether or not something is patentable. It's not the absolute concrete test, but it's the clue. And the third point is what I just said. He says the machine or transformation test it's always been a useful and important clue, but has never been the sole test. So actually his second and third points are kind of exactly the same. So,
well, there's this, throughout the opinion, there's this the clue versus a clue, which becomes rather important, right? Because if it's the clue, it's really the main indicator. If it's a clue, it's one among many that they're hoping the lower court will come up with later, right? So you sort of have to read the article there with a lot of
right.
Detail.
So in the future, when the judge decides which way she wants to rule, if she wants to rule in one way, she'll cite the, it's just a clue, but it's not the only thing, and then she'll decide however she wants to decide. But if a judge wants to use a machine or transformation test to make the decision, then the judge will say, well, they'll cite this part, which says it is the clue. So there's enough for everyone here. It's like legislation, which really doesn't do anything, but there's enough for everyone to claim victory. But
I think they all need to get a clue.
the biggest thing I've circled in this whole opinion is in this paragraph on page 3 of Breyer's concurrence, where he says, rather, the court has emphasized that a process claim meets the requirements of Section 101 when, quote, considered as a whole, it is performing a function which the patent laws were designed to protect, open parens, e.g., transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing, close parens, close quote. And I think that e.g. explains the entire opinion, because if it had been an i.e. instead of e.g., I think that would imply a difference. As the Latin scholar, do you want to explain the difference between EG and IE?
I would not want to declare myself a Latin scholar, but I do know both Latin terms, and I just checked because I knew you were going there to make sure I had it right. So EG means exempli gratia, which means for the sake of example or for the benefit of example. And IE means id est, which means the thing itself or the thing is. So you can think, mathematically, you could think of IE as almost an equal sign. It is the same as this thing. This is another way of saying it. EG would be a part of the whole. It would be one detailed example of a more general concept that precedes it. So that would be the difference. And how is that difference, do you think, would make a big deal here?
Well, let's read this quote, which comes from the case called Diamond v. Deere, which was the last Supreme Court case about the patentability of software.
If people want to go back and review, 1-8 is the episode we talk about Diamond v. Deere in detail.
Right. So here's the quote. Okay. Something is patentable when it's performing a function which the patent laws were designed to protect, e.g. transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing. So that means something is patentable if it is performing a function which patent laws were designed to protect. For example, one of many things, for example, transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing. So that's where they're saying, if it transforms an article to a different state or thing, that's one of the functions that the patent laws are designed to protect. That makes it patentable. Now let's imagine that it was an IE instead of EG. And it says, instead, if it said, you can have a patent on something if it is performing a function which the patent laws were designed to protect, i.e. transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing. That is transforming or reducing an article to a different state or thing. So in the first understanding, which is what Deere does say, it's saying transformation of an article is one of the functions that patents were meant to protect. Whereas if it had said i.e., then that would be the only function that patents were meant to protect.
But we were debating this before, and I was sort of saying, well, that's just wishful thinking, because obviously when they wrote Deere, they chose EG on purpose, right? Or could it have been a typo?
That would be a very interesting question.
It would be. A lot of people misuse those terms. But, yeah.
Hopefully this SCOTUS does not.
Hopefully the law clerk, right?
Yeah. Oh,
right. Of course, yeah, it's all the law clerks.
So and, just to continue with Breyer's opinion, he says this: the machine or transformation is thus an italicizes this for emphasis, an important example of how a court can determine patentability under 101, but the Federal Circuit erred in this case by treating it as the exclusive test. So what I think they're saying is the machine or transformation is a positive test, which means if you pass the machine or transformation test, you deserve a patent. If you fail it, you don't not deserve a patent. There's just some other test that you might need to pass, and the court doesn't really tell you what that other test might be, except for this, as long as it's not an abstract idea.
And pretty much anything that's pure software will fail machine or transformation, because it neither is a machine nor does it transform matter in the real world.
But that doesn't mean it's likely to pass another test.
Right.
But there might be another test.
We don't know what the test is going to be that applies to software. And then the last thing Breyer says of his 4 points that everyone agrees on is, although the machine or transformation test is not the only test for patentability, this by no means indicates that anything which produces a useful, concrete, and tangible result is patentable. And the useful, concrete, tangible result test is a test from State Street. So what he's saying is the machine transformation test is not requisite, but the test is not so lax as to be the useful, concrete, tangible result test of State Street. So the test for patentable processes is going to be somewhere in the middle, and we don't know exactly where it is, and we'll just have to see.
So does that overturn State Street by saying that?
Yes. It preclusively says State Street was wrong. That's not the correct test, because State Street said anything that has a useful, concrete, tangible result is patentable. And they're saying, nope, that's not true, because there are things that could have useful, concrete, tangible results that are not patentable. But Bilski, then, the Federal Circuit opinion, said it has to have a machine or transformation to be patentable. And they're saying, nope, that's not wrong either. So State Street, you were too easy of a test. Bilski, you were too hard of a test. So the true test is somewhere in the middle.
And you can still pass the hard test, because if you pass the hard test, you still get an A, i.e. you still get a patent. But you might be able to pass weaker tests and get a B or a C okay patent.
If a patent fails the State Street test, then that's still invalid. If it passes machine or transformation test, then it is valid. In between State Street and Bilski, we don't know exactly.
So we know how people get A's, we know how they get F's, but we don't know how they get D's, C's, and B's, basically.
Right.
We'll have to find out later.
Right. So that's the Bilski opinion. So I've just summarized for you the total of 70-some pages of the whole opinion.
Hopefully you all read it as homework anyway. So this is just a review, not your first introduction to the material.
You can come to us instead of reading
it. By the time they hear us, I hope everybody's read it. We have good hardworking listeners who do their homework.
Well,
we hope.
I hope they didn't waste their time reading Stevens's opinion. But anyways,
The part about the English law lotteries thing, I was glad I read it. It was worth reading.
It's entertaining. Yes. If you want to read it for entertainment value, by all means, be my guest. But I'm not a big fan of fiction.
So as a patent lawyer who works to stop software patents, what does this change for you in your work? How are you going to approach the problem of stopping software patents and even stopping other types of patents that you've tried to stop?
We're going to do exactly the same thing we've been doing.
This doesn't give you any new tools?
It doesn't really, like you said earlier, you were very correct in saying this puts us basically back where we were a year and a half ago before the Bilski brouhaha started. And so we're back to, we can make an argument that software is ineligible. We can say it's on, just like we did in our brief, which people should feel free to read our brief, that we think even under this test that the Supreme Court set today in Bilski, that software is still not patentable subject matter. And there's nothing in the opinion today that disputes our position, that changes our opinion. We rely on the exact cases that the Supreme Court today says are still good law, still binding law.
And to walk people through that argument, it's because software is an algorithm, and therefore
it's all abstract ideas.
It's an abstract idea. An algorithm is an abstract idea. They've said if something is an abstract idea, it's not patentable, and we say algorithms are all abstract ideas, software is all algorithms, mm-hmm. therefore no software is patentable.
Right. And the clue that software is not patentable is that software fails a machine or transformation test. So we at least have a clue on our side. And we have all the prior precedent on our side.
We have a clue. Not the clue.
I will say the clue. Because it's in my favor, I will say the clue. Our opponents will say it's just a clue. And unfortunately, this just means there's more uncertainty going forward. At the same time, people should continue to make themselves informed and engaged and feel empowered. Things could have been worse. Things could have been better. We still are moving forward and, the day will come for the decision that we all expect. It's just going to be a day a little bit farther from now than it could have been.
Well, and I think the advice you gave our listeners earlier on in our discussion here is a good one. You didn't say this directly, but sort of hinting at avoid products that are heavily covered by software patents. Go to free software where, if there are software patents involved, you have licenses, and avoid products from companies that are trying to have patented technologies in their stuff.
I just saw this morning that Apple sold 1.7 million iPhone 4s. And for all the other reasons to object to the iPhone is the fact that Apple has filed patent infringement cases against the makers of Android phones. And that should just be unacceptable, intolerable corporate behavior that has a deleterious effect on society. And when you see someone with an iPhone, you should reject them in the same way as if they were undertaking some other socially undesirable contact, such as, 50 years ago, frequenting a diner that would not serve black people, or 20 years ago, eating tuna fish that was not dolphin safe, or 5 years. What would you say to someone who was riding around and they went pulled into a BP gas station today to get gas? I mean, if this is an issue that you care about...
Or, for example, people who insist on printing on only one side of the paper and don't make full use of the paper. You should give them a hard time, right?
If it's necessary to print on one side of the paper so that you can read it, so you can do good...
But meanwhile, the single-sided printout was useful for several of us in the office.
That's true. Okay.
Well, yeah. Dan, thank you for cluing us in.
Thanks again for being a full guest, and I think our listeners will really enjoy your walkthrough. And it was really nice of you to walk through the whole case for them. We really appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
So, was it Justice Stevens with the dagger in the conservatory? Or was it Justice Sotomayor with the candlestick in the library?